Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know, around here, we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to schools to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, where a 529 plan can help meet your college savings goals. Details at putnam.com. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
It's going to be a pretty neat trick now, saving the U.S. car industry. Those threats Senate Republicans were making yesterday to kill the bailout, I guess they meant it. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Clarkson Potter, publishers of The Splendid Tables, How to Eat Supper, a holiday gift idea for people who love to eat, now available at splendidtable.org. And by Thomson Reuters, a source of intelligent information to businesses and professionals around the world. Thomson Reuters, knowledge to act.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Today is Thursday, the 11th of December, and it is great to have you here. You know, it's not often you can pinpoint the moment an entire American industry looks its future square in the face. But it happened today, courtesy of Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell.
Republicans will not allow taxpayers to subsidize failure.
It never was a sure thing, this bailout for Detroit. Today, Senator McConnell and his colleagues made it pretty clear the only sure thing is that the deal the White House and congressional Democrats agreed to is not happening. That leaves us with these facts. General Motors says it doesn't have enough cash to last till New Year's. Chrysler is almost as bad off. Ford says it's going to need help if one of the others goes under. So this seems like a pretty good point to ask, what happens next? Marketplace's Alisa Roth has the answers.
The real question is how much longer the Detroit Three can hang on and how many more ways they can think of to cut costs until presumably the Obama administration comes in and bails them out. Bruce Belzowski is at the University of Michigan's Transportation Research Institute. He says the timing's actually pretty good as these things go, since all three are getting ready for extended holiday shutdowns anyway. That'll save some money. After that, he says, the first step would be to get rid of research and development and focus on the here and now.
To make sure that you could get the product that you have available and already developed out to the dealers.
That means you keep plants running, but only very selectively. There is another plan B, as in bankruptcy, but Belzowski thinks that could be risky since they might never get out of it. Right now, though, the bigger problem is that all the car makers in North America, including Toyota and Honda, use many of the same suppliers.
If one of the major manufacturers goes out, some of its major suppliers go out as well. And then you start having some of the dealers go out because they no longer have vehicles to sell, and now you've got a domino effect.
And once the dealers get involved, the trouble will spread well beyond Detroit. Ron Harber is an analyst with the consulting firm Oliver Wyman. He points out there is another possible solution.
All along, President Bush has had the ability to go ahead and sign this thing and get it done, but he's been unwilling to do that.
If the president doesn't change his mind and no money comes through, the Detroit Three will just have to sit tight and hope they can make it to the Obama administration. In New York, I'm Alisa Roth for Marketplace.
The Commerce Department reported today that the U.S. trade gap widened in October. The increase caught a lot of analysts by surprise because both imports and exports were down for the third month in a row. So you'd think the deficit would stay relatively stable. Turns out the culprit was oil. Crude imports rose by a record amount in October, which is kind of odd considering the economic state of affairs, as Marketplace's Sam Eaton explains.
Riding the bus into work this morning, I noticed something out of sync with today's $1.66 gasoline. The bus was packed in Los Angeles. And all across the country, the hordes of people who started taking public transit and driving less when gas was $4 are sticking with it. So a lot of people scratched their heads when October's trade deficit rose because of a record jump in oil imports. Analyst Tom Closa with the Oil Price Information Service says, stop scratching.
It's a quirk or a fluke, depending on your semantics here.
Closa says oil imports rose in October not because of any boost in demand, but because it marked the final days of the oil price bonanza.
that was really before we got most of the information that suggested just how considerable the demand destruction was.
He says that lag effect actually creates even more downward pressure on oil prices going forward, because even though people are using a lot less of the stuff, OPEC continues to churn out as much oil as it did during the boom times. Economist Philip Verleger predicts the price of gas will soon drop as low as $1.25. And he says even if OPEC cuts supply when it meets next week, it won't be enough to prop up prices.
The cuts they're talking about today are almost certainly not enough, given the rapidly deteriorating state of the global economy.
Verleger says in the short term, that's good news for the U.S. trade deficit and for consumers. But he says if cheap gas slows progress on things like fuel efficiency, the long run could be another story. In Los Angeles, I'm Sam Eaton for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, oil prices rose, stocks fell. Simple as that. Kind of feels like the good old days. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. As bad as last Friday's monthly unemployment report was, the pink slips keep on coming. The Labor Department says the number of people claiming first-time jobless benefits has hit a 26-year high. 573,000 people signed up for state help last week, some of them from the financial industry. Just today, Bank of America announced as many as 35,000 layoffs over the next 3 years. Marketplace's Amy Scott is keeping an eye on how this crisis is changing the culture of Wall Street. And last night, she spent some time with the recently unemployed at a holiday party of sorts.
I found Chris Lewis by the bar, clutching a folder full of papers. Turned out it was his severance package. Lewis had been let go from his job at Credit Suisse just hours before. He was on his way home when he remembered an invitation he'd received to a Wall Street pink slip party at a bar in Lower Manhattan. Come jingle and mingle, it said, with folks who want to help you get a new position in 09.
I was just walking to the subway, then immediately struck me, no, Chris, don't go home. Okay, go and meet some people. There might be a lot of people who are in the same boat as you are.
He was right. Hundreds of men and women milled about, sipping drinks and exchanging business cards. The event was part of a series of parties aimed at matching out-of-work Wall Streeters with potential jobs. Pink glow-in-the-dark bracelets separated the job seekers from the recruiters who wore green. Dilip Pitty Kitty fell into the pink category. He lost his job as a research associate at a small broker-dealer a few months ago. He says he's been getting by on some part-time work.
Like dog walking on the Upper West Side and the government money, the unemployment benefits kind of, and also for my parents too. They pay for my month's rent.
24-year-old Munira Ahmed has been living with her parents. She graduated from college last spring only to face the worst job market in decades.
It is a very hard slap in the face because college was not a breeze, you know, so all the work that was supposed to pay off at the end, it's just not.
At the other end of the career spectrum, Richard Rabbit Ryan was more philosophical. He's worked in one finance job or another since the early 80s, so he's seen cycles.
I enjoyed my job. I went to work every day. I gave 110%. And when my parent company decided they had to lay off tens of thousands of people, I was one of them cut. What can I do about it?
Maybe not much for a while. Ryan says nobody hires in December. He plans to enjoy the holidays and start fresh in the new year. In New York, I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
You know that old line about those who don't remember history being condemned to repeat it? There is a certain element of that in the crisis du jour. I mean, it's not like Wall Street hasn't had experience losing boatloads of other people's money before. Former Wall Street analyst Henry Blodgett writes about why Wall Street always blows it in the current edition of the Atlantic Monthly. Good to have you with us.
Great to be here. Thank you for having me.
You know a thing or two about bubbles on Wall Street. Did this one catch you off guard?
This one caught me less off guard than the first one. to provide background, I was a technology analyst at Merrill Lynch, and I covered internet stocks. And I was definitely aware that it was possible that it was a bubble. And toward the end of it, I thought it probably was a bubble. And yet I still managed to drive myself and my clients right off the cliff. In the housing market, I was, I would say, early in saying, hey, wait a minute, this looks very similar to what was going on in technology. And in fact, I personally made the opposite mistake in the housing bubble, which was to get out too early.
But you were, and there are on Wall Street now, a bunch of people who are the smartest guys in the room. And if that's true, how come we're all so broke?
Well, I think you see the smartest guys in the room on Wall Street make this same mistake. And I think there are a lot of reasons for that. To start with, if you go back into the boom phase of any bubble, what you'll find is that just about every constituency that is participating in the decisions that further the bubble is thrilled with the boom. So you have a self-reinforcing cycle where it's in everyone's interest to keep it going. And it takes an incredibly rare, strong, and confident voice to say, now, hey, wait a minute, we are setting the table for disaster.
And arguably, all those people you mentioned, they're all acting, at least in the short term, rationally, right?
The decisions that are made in bubbles are much more rational than people think in hindsight. To take it back to the level of a real estate broker, you want to sell the house. It's not really your job to say, hey, most of these economists who are saying house prices are going to go up are wrong. I think that they're going to drop. Therefore, I'm not going to sell any houses. And so in the context of that, they are rational.
Post facto, as you look back at a bubble, is there a sense of culpability or regret on the part of some of these people, do you think?
I think there's huge regret. I mean, for me, it was I had seen the bubble forming. I had gotten wide open in the end zone, and the game-winning pass was coming down, and it hit me in the chest, and I dropped it. I mean, I just felt like I'd made a tremendous error, and I think a lot of people are feeling that. I'm sure Alan Greenspan is feeling that, because I think if you're going to look at the single biggest factor of why this housing bubble came in, it was that he kept interest rates too low for too long. Everything is screamingly obvious in hindsight, and anybody who cares about the decisions they make is going to look back with a lot of regret.
The next time we're in a bubble, are we going to be smart enough to say, yeah, no, it's not really different this time? You remember back at the turn of the century?
I think that some people will, and a lot of the people who will say it is not different, this is just the same thing all over again, are going to be those of us who are still alive who went through this period. Of course, at that time, we're going to be dismissed as cranks who are now totally out of touch and we don't understand the world has changed. But there are also a lot of smart people who are saying it is different this time and here's why it's different. I think a really important point about bubbles is that the logic saying it's different has to be persuasive. Otherwise, nobody would believe it. And again, if you go back to the tech bubble, you had Alan Greenspan saying, look, the internet is making things different. It is creating the ability for the economy to grow faster without overheating than it ever has before. That logic is very hard to refute. Again, it takes an extreme amount of knowledge and confidence to say, you know what? That is just simply wrong.
Henry Blodgett, he's the editor of Silicon Alley Insider. The article we're talking about is in the current edition of The Atlantic Magazine. It's called Why Wall Street Always Blows It. Henry, thanks a lot.
Thank you for having me.
Coming up, you think residential real estate is lousy?
The credit markets behind commercial real estate blew up a month ago. Absolutely blew up.
It's another conversation from the corner office, but first, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrials gave back 2.25% today, 196 points to close at 8,565. The NASDAQ fell 3.75%, 57 points, ended at 1507. The S&P 500 sheared off 2.8%, 25 points, finished at 873. More uncertainty over the bailout through auto stocks off course, of course. Shares in General Motors and Ford each lost more than 10% today. Financial shares also drove markets down. J.P. Morgan unloaded 10.75%. That after CEO Jamie Dimon told CNBC that the quarter would be, quote, terrible. Merrill Lynch and Bank of America also sliced off more than 10%. Citigroup escaped with a 9% loss. Healthcare stocks logged some healthy returns. United Health Group, the country's biggest medical insurer, shot up nearly 9% today. Aetna claimed an extra 3.3%. Bond prices rose. The yield on the 10-year T-note fell to 2.61%. and you are listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Vanguard, offering investments designed to help individuals, institutions, and advisors reach their long-term financial goals. 888-VANGUARD. Conversations from the Corner Office, Dialogues with Top CEOs, is supported by the Society for Human Resource Management, online at shrm.org. Want more from Marketplace's special Fallout coverage? It's all on our website. You'll find special podcasts, videos, and the Marketplace Decoder, a simple guide to financial terms and products. Go to marketplace.org.
From the Marketplace Statebook, here's a look at events coming up Friday. The Commerce Department reports on retail sales for November. The Radio Television Correspondents Association holds its annual meeting in the Senate Radio TV Gallery. And it's National Poinsettia Day, held annually on December 12th, the death anniversary of Joel Roberts Poinsett in 1851. He was the first U.S. ambassador to Mexico and brought the Christmassy plant up from south of the border. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdahl. You know, the bottom line is a dangerous place this year. Lots of scary numbers down there. But nonprofits that depend on charity are hoping that despite the tight times, people and companies are still going to share a little with the most needy. Because as good as it feels to get, it can feel even better to give.
When I give, I get a sense of joy.
A sense of giving back.
I feel happy about making someone else happy.
It's just karma.
As we wrap up our look at philanthropy this week, a moment now for the groups on the receiving end of your donations. People have been saying for years that nonprofits ought to act more like regular businesses, the ones that do make a profit. Commentator Dan Pallotta couldn't agree more.
We let business pay people based on value, but we don't want people making money in charity. Want to make $1 million as a CEO selling violent video games to kids? Go for it. Want to make $1 million curing kids of cancer? You're a parasite. So our top business school grads gravitate to the for-profit sector. We let business advertise till the last dollar no longer produces a penny of value, but we don't want charitable donations spent on advertising. So charities can't build demand for causes. Budweiser's all over the Super Bowl. AIDS in Darfur? Absent. We let business make mistakes, but expect charity to spend contributions cautiously. It's okay if a $100 million Disney movie flops, but if a $5 million charity walk doesn't show a 75% profit year one, call the Attorney General. So charities can't develop learning curves for revenue generation. Amazon could forgo investor returns for 6 years to build market dominance, but if a charity embarks on a long-term plan with no return for the needy for 6 years, we expect a crucifixion. Business can offer profits to attract investment capital, but there's no stock market for charity, so the for-profit sector monopolizes the multi-trillion dollar capital markets. No competitive compensation, no advertising, no risk-taking, no long-term vision, and no capital markets. A perfect storm of prohibition that puts the nonprofit sector at extreme disadvantage to the for-profit sector. We blame capitalism for the inequities in society and then refuse to let charity use the tools of capitalism to rectify them. Maybe capitalism isn't the problem. Maybe the lack of it is. It's been banished from charity by a Puritan ethic of deprivation that considers it contaminating. Maybe an ethic that stands in the way of progress is an ethic whose time is done.
Dan Pallotta is the author of Uncharitable, How Restraints on Nonprofits Undermine Their Potential. You can send us your thoughts online is best. Our website is marketplace.org. As Dan Pallotta said, nonprofits are trying to figure out ways to survive, especially in this economy, when the need for their services is more intense than ever. We didn't have to go all that far to find out what that means in real life. At 5 in the afternoon, the Los Angeles Boys and Girls Club is already humming. Kids have been filtering in for hours. Executive Director Juana Lambert shows us around.
So this is the games room, and as you can see, it's very popular.
It's a huge rec room with 25 or 30 boys crowded around a couple of ping pong tables. Outside, another dozen or so are playing on what Lambert hopes will soon be a brand new baseball diamond. In all, about 100 kids walk from school or are picked up in the club van every afternoon. In the summertime, more than 300 of them show up for swimming lessons, soccer practice, and supervision. Because Lambert points out, this isn't really the greatest neighborhood.
We are in the midst of four gang injunctions. Every single street here is a different gang with a different gang injunction. And so our kids are constantly threatened by people who are trying to have them become members of their gang, at middle school especially.
Carol Scott's picking up her little boy, Davian. He's 10 years old. He's been coming here for 3 years.
I mean, it's a place for him to come where he can have fun and do different things and meet different people and do different arts and crafts. And I mean, you know, it's just safer.
None of it's cheap, though, and the $15 that parents pay for the whole year, that's right, $15 for the whole year, doesn't cover all that much. And Director Juana Lambert worries that in the middle of a recession, other funds are going to dry up, too.
We're very, very aware of the fact that our foundations are very cautious about the money that they're giving. The city has cut back. As of December 30th, we were losing one of our major grants from the city of Los Angeles. So we're being hit hard like everybody else.
Hit with a loss of more than 10% of her $700,000 a year budget. But upstairs, the kids are blissfully unaware.
Where do you think the money comes from to run this place?
From taxes that our parents pay.
No, from the government?
No way.
I think there's a big machine that you put some, like, a little code and it makes money.
Always one wise guy, right? 8-year-old Kiara Lopez is next door. She's sitting with her friends, writing on a whiteboard.
What do you do?
We're playing teachers.
So what's your favorite part of the Boys and Girls Club?
Swimming pool.
How come?
Because you could swim and you could exercise and you could have fun.
Kiara says if she wasn't at the club, she'd be at home.
Sometimes me and my friend, we take care of my brothers in the house. One of my brothers is 3 and the other one is 1.
We ran into her mom at pickup time. She does find somebody to watch Kiara and her brothers, but it's a stretch given what she makes as a cleaning lady. And that pressure on the family is what worries Juana Lambert. She knows that as tough as things are for the club, they're worse for the families it serves. Lambert's had to cut back hours for computer lab, the art program might go, but she's bound and determined to build that baseball diamond out back.
We got to cut back, but we got to make it. I've seen people give me articles and say, see, these other organizations aren't doing their development. What are we going to do? Are we going to, we should cut back and not build our field. I'm going to try to build this field, economy or no economy.
If you want to get a sense of the Los Angeles Boys and Girls Club and to hear all the pieces in our philanthropy series, go to our website. It's marketplace.org. Imagine if you could have seen the whole real estate mess coming, that you had some indicator that tipped you off that things were about to get really bad. The analogy is not perfect, I know, but commercial property managers had something like that. It's called the residential market. But even though they knew problems were coming as they saw the housing market tank, still, nobody buys skyscrapers and shopping malls in a recession.
The boss will see you now.
Today on Conversations from the Corner Office, Brett White, the CEO of CB Richard Ellis. That's the world's biggest commercial property management company. White says as bad as things are, they're not all bad.
The way that this down cycle appeared was in the credit markets. And what the credit markets did was they froze. This began August 2007. It's just gotten worse every month since. And that has manifested itself in a steady decline in the buying and selling of commercial real estate. The volumes in that business globally are at unprecedented low levels.
With the value of properties low, there's got to be some bargains out there. Where are those bargains?
There are bargains. And I would say that, as a rule, anyone who is selling into this marketplace right now is distressed. And by definition, a distressed sale is a great opportunity for a buyer that can wait out this cycle.
Are we talking about high-rise office buildings in major urban areas, or are we talking about strip malls in
suburban Detroit? I mean, what are we talking about here?
The math is even easier than that.
All right.
The math is any asset.
Really?
Of any type. This is my view.
Yeah,
it may
yeah.
not be your view. Of any type right now that someone is selling this week is probably going out at a historically low valuation, whether it's equities, whether it's commodities, whether it's real estate.
Well, that gets into the whole are we at the bottom thing. Don't you worry that maybe we're not, specifically now in commercial property, which is your area, don't you worry we're not at the bottom yet?
I don't think we are at the bottom, but there are unique things happening right now that are impacting the commercial real estate asset class, and that is that the credit markets behind commercial real estate blew up a month ago, absolutely blew up. There are very few buyers in the marketplace of any sort right now, and there's almost no credit available right now. That situation will correct a bit, I believe, in the coming months, and will allow valuations to find their right level. As a rule, though, the asset class is devaluing as we speak, and it probably isn't done.
So even if we're not at the bottom now, we'll go a little farther, but in terms of historical trends, we're eventually going to see an upside, and this is an opportunity.
Absolutely. There have been hundreds of billions of dollars of equity raised in 2008 for this asset class. Of those hundreds of billions of dollars have been raised, my guess is a single-digit percentage has been put to work. All that money is parked on the sideline waiting to enter the marketplace. I think we're getting it close.
It's got to drive you crazy knowing all this money's out there.
Well, it does. We've raised some of it. And our firm has raised close to $5 billion of equity this year for investment. And we're on the sideline also, waiting for that point in time. But I think we're getting very close.
So what's it going to take? When are you going to call the chairman of the board and you're going to have a big board meeting? You're going to say, okay, now.
I think we're close to there. In our asset class, I think it's true in most businesses, it's impossible to time the bottom. What you want to do is be generally correct. So, you know, I saw someone on television the other morning talking about equities, which I know nothing about. But this person's point was, if you could buy into equities today and you knew that they might devalue another 20% over the next year, but they will increase in value 60% over 2 years, are you a buyer? And the answer is yes. Same's true for this asset class.
Brett White is the president and CEO of CB Richard Ellis. Mr. White, thanks a lot for your time.
Thank you very much.
You can hear conversations from other corner offices at our website. It's marketplace.org.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, managing nearly $8 billion in municipal bond assets. Details at putnam.com. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication.
This final note today, in an economy that's inspiring a whole bunch of superlatives, as in the worst crisis since the Great Depression, I've got another one for you. For the very first time since the Federal Reserve has been keeping track, American consumers are cutting back on debt. Not by a whole lot, mind you, just 0.8%, but still pretty good. What's not so great, though, is why. Mostly we're spending less because we feel poorer. The Fed reported today household net worth dropped, too, also by the biggest amount on record. And that is Marketplace from American Public Media. Today the Dow lost 2.25%, 196 points, closed at 8,565. The NASDAQ fell 3.75%, 57 points, ended at 1507. The S&P 500 sheared off 2.8%, 25 points, finished at 873. Stephen Gregory, John Haas, Patty Hirsch, Betsy Streisand, and Lisa Tucker are the Marketplace editing staff. The managing editor of the program is George Judson. Coming up next time, a Wall Street preacher shares his perspective on the financial crisis.
On one level, I'm reminding them, you know, that there's bad news in the market, but what we're about as a spiritual people is to embrace the good news. That no matter how dark it gets, there is a light.
I'm Kai Rizdahl. Hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.